And now they wait. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thousands of migrants are now in Tijuana, waiting for a chance to seek asylum in the U.S. But that chance will not come right away.
So now they're faced with the prospect of just staying in this shelter, sleeping outside on tarps for another month.
Also, the California wildfires have already destroyed lives and destroyed whole neighborhoods. Now the smoke from those fires is causing serious health concerns. Our editor, who used to live in Mexico City and coped with dangerous air pollution there, says the air quality in Northern California is a whole lot worse.
Worst days in Mexico City when kids weren't allowed to be outside is nothing compared to this.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you here this Monday. We start today with an update on the migrants from Central America heading north to the U.S. We've been following their progress for over a month, and now a group of about 3,000 migrants is in Tijuana, Mexico. Many of them are crowded into a sports complex there, waiting for a chance to apply for asylum here, north of the border. But it could be a long wait. Emily Green has been covering the story for us in Tijuana. Over the weekend, she was there as mainly Mexican protesters held a demonstration to let the migrants know that they are not welcome in the city.
Tijuana, unida, jamás será vencida. Tijuana, unida, jamás será vencida.
So the protest started around 9:30 in the morning. There were about 300 protesters, and they all seemed to be from Tijuana. And they were very anti-caravan. They were saying that the migrants in the caravan were violent, were not appreciative of what had been given to them, the food, the clothes, and that they weren't integrating into Tijuana. The migrants only have been here in Tijuana for about 3 to 4 days, so it's pretty hard to integrate. But essentially a feeling that these migrants were invaders.
Are there people in Tijuana supporting the migrants? Is anyone helping out?
There's a lot of people and organizations who are supporting the migrants and donating food and clothes, you know, and support their journey. But I do think that the feelings here are complex. You know, I've been following this caravan for about a month now. Here in Tijuana, I have seen more anti-migrant than I've seen anywhere else in the country. Perhaps that makes sense because in the other parts of the country, the caravan was largely passing through. They weren't planning to stay. The truth is a lot of the migrants are going to end up staying here in Tijuana because they're not going to reach the United States. Government officials are estimating that as many as 10,000 migrants could arrive here in Tijuana in the next couple of weeks.
Emily, thanks for that. Let's hear more of your reporting now from Tijuana.
Blankets, tarps, and people cover most of this outdoor sports complex. Men mill around in groups talking. Kids play on a jungle gym. Mirna Amaya rests on a blanket. Her 7-year-old daughter, Ellen, plays with a doll nearby. Mirna is thinking about applying for asylum, but isn't sure. She plans to wait until even more migrants arrive, and then go to the border as one big group. She says there has to be a deal to let us in, because there are too many of us. Ernesto Amaya is skeptical this plan will work. He lived in the U.S. for more than 7 years. He has 2 daughters in Ohio, 6 and 10. He last saw them 6 months ago, right before he was deported, for selling guns illegally.
I want to see my girl again, you know, that's what I'm here for.
But Ernesto says there's no chance the U.S. will let him in, so he's going to wait a few months, work in Tijuana, save some money, and then try his luck crossing the border illegally.
These people think that they're just going to go down there and get some paper, or they're just going to cross. I know that's not true. They're not going to get papers today. They're just going to cross and get to immigration jail and get deported.
Ernesto is right on one account. Only a small percentage of people who claim asylum in the U.S. actually get it. But the migrants here feel so close to their dream of reaching the U.S., they're not going to give it up. Still, they're desperate for information. So when 3 lawyers from New York University show up at the shelter, hundreds of people crowd around. A volunteer on a loudspeaker implores the migrants to get into two lines and wait their turn to talk to the lawyers, only one of whom speaks Spanish. So the lawyers ask me to translate, and for the next hour, I help attorney Alina Das field questions.
How long does an asylum case take to fight?
It depends. Right now, there's a backlog. It takes a long time, but it'll depend on the type of case you have.
Podría ser largo. Podría ser largo.
At one point, the one Spanish-speaking attorney gets on a loudspeaker.
Solo hay que esperar hasta que llamen su número.
She yells out that for those seeking asylum in the U.S., the first step is to go to the official port of entry and ask for a number. This generates more confusion. A number? The lawyer says there's a wait list to ask for asylum, and the number signifies where you are on that list. People are still confused, but the next morning, hundreds go to the port of entry.
Entonces, deme su nombre, entonces.
Somos una familia de seis.
Okay. Todas vienen de la caravana y del albergue Benito Juárez.
A woman writes down everyone's information in a notebook and gives them a number. This is a list to enter the U.S. legally and ask for asylum. There are more than 3,000 people on that list, which started in January.
Ahí está. Dentro de tres semanas venga a consultar por dónde va la lista.
The woman with the notebook tells people to come back in 3 weeks to check in. But it will likely be months before their number comes up. U.S. Border Patrol is only accepting around 90 asylum seekers a day because it says they can't process more. Marjorie Castillo and her husband Darian Carbajal walk away, heads down. They left Honduras 5 weeks ago with their three young daughters. Darian says he got death threats because he refused to join a gang. They want to enter the U.S. legally, at a port of entry, and ask for asylum, but they're getting desperate.
Y pues la verdad, de mi parte, de la parte de nosotros, no creo que aguantemos eso.
Darian says he doesn't think they can stand more months of waiting. Their daughters are suffering. He says at the shelter there's no water, or food, or medicine.
Pues la otra opción es cruzar pacíficamente la.
He says they're thinking about crossing into the U.S. illegally and asking for asylum. But earlier this month, President Trump signed an order that basically makes migrants who enter the country illegally, outside of a port of entry, ineligible for asylum. Marjorie and Darian didn't know about this, and it worries them even more. Back at the sports complex, people are restless, anxious. One man approaches me. Of all the people here, how many do you think are actually going to get asylum? He asks. I'm not a lawyer, I say. But what do you think? He says. So I tell him. Not many, but some will. Yeah, he says. There's a lot of us. Those who are here and those still coming. More caravans of Central Americans are currently headed to Tijuana, also with dreams of reaching the U.S. For The World, Emily Green, Tijuana, Mexico.
What would you do if you lived in a small town and all the doctors had to leave? That's what some Brazilians are facing right now. One reason why? Brazil's president-elect is not a big fan of Cuba. Jair Bolsonaro doesn't take office until January, but he's already rolling back a program that helped place thousands of Cuban doctors in remote parts of Brazil. The two countries reached a deal 5 years ago, and ever since, Cuban physicians have served in some of Brazil's poorest areas. It's been a boon to the country's poverty-stricken indigenous communities. But Cuba's government has been pocketing most of the physicians' salaries, and Bolsonaro says he's not going to stand for that.
Não podemos admitir escravos cubanos no Brasil. Não podemos admitir isso. E não podemos continuar alimentando a ditadura cubana.
We cannot allow Cuban slaves to work in Brazil, Bolsonaro told reporters in Rio yesterday, and we cannot continue feeding the Cuban dictatorship. So Cuba is calling the doctors home. Reporter Catherine Osborne has been watching the reaction in Rio de Janeiro.
This program is kind of like a Teach for America program from the Brazilian government. They place doctors in far-flung cities where people wouldn't necessarily have their first choice to go, usually a rural small city or even an indigenous village. And Cuba has been a huge exporter of medical services over the years. The export of medical services is actually responsible for the majority of Cuba's total exports, over $10 billion per year. And so Cuba has sent thousands of doctors to Brazil over the last few years since this program was started in 2013. And they're doctors who want to have a different experience, who've heard about this opportunity. But the complicated thing is they get to Brazil and they're earning under half of the salary that is paid to the Cuban government for them to be there.
So Cuba's got a lot of doctors, so they're sharing them out in kind of a goodwill gesture, but they're also making money on these doctors. How much do the Cuban doctors make and how much does the Cuban government make for their services?
The Cuban government has a contract with the Brazilian government that earns about $800 per month per doctor. But the Cuban government retains a majority of that money. So the doctors themselves are earning under $400 per month. And it's crazy because the Brazilian doctors who are in the same program earn over $3,000 per month. So it's already a much lower price starting out. And then the Cuban government takes a cut off that. The doctors do receive housing and food stipend from the local government of the cities where they're stationed. But still, the takeaway pay is really, really low. And in the past 2 years in Brazil, over 150 Cuban doctors have even filed lawsuits in Brazilian courts to challenge the program, saying that it's not fair, calling to be treated as independent contractors who are earning full pay.
So the doctors, it seems, are instead going back to Cuba. But were they qualified? I mean, Bolsonaro seems to suggest they're not qualified.
The first preference for doctors in this program were people who did have their degrees checked through this verification program. And then if there weren't enough people filling the spaces, people who didn't have their degrees validated could participate. So, you know, it's a valid critique about were they fully qualified to work here. But at the same time, Bolsonaro is not really in a position ideologically to say, oh, we're going to have higher labor standards in Brazil, because he's in the past been very unattentive to allegations of slave labor carried out by big companies in Brazil. So he's making a critique that's ideologically oriented. For him, it's all about how, in his view, Cuba is a dictatorship. He says that. He says, you know, we're not going to support slavery and we're not going to empower Cuba's dictatorship. And so he's being more attentive to labor standards and qualifications in this case than in a lot of others.
So as far as the doctors' families, they were not allowed to relocate with them to Brazil, and that was to prevent defections, right?
Correct. Again, the doctors themselves have critiqued their working conditions. At the same time, the mayors of the towns where the Cuban doctors went to are very upset at all of this news. And today, Brazil's current president, Michel Temer, is meeting with mayors from towns across the country who are upset, who are saying that, listen, it's going to take months to fill these vacancies. So even though it was difficult conditions for the doctors, it was also a position that was hard to fill.
If these Cuban doctors, Catherine, suddenly decided they want to stay in Brazil, will Bolsonaro's government offer them asylum?
I think that's to be seen still. What we know now is that Bolsonaro has also, in other statements, taken very anti-immigrant stances. So he's criticized Venezuelan migrants as people who shouldn't be able to be in Brazil. So it's possible that they face difficulties if they want to stay even after the program is over.
Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Later on The World, we'll hear about the Bolsonaro effect on the Amazon rainforest. And coming up here after the break, the deadly fires in California have turned the air there into a toxic soup. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A soupy gray smog. That's what many Californians are facing today. But thankfully, there's rain in the forecast that could help firefighters finally get things under control. It might also clear up the air. All the smoke from the worst ever California forest fires is choking millions of people across the northern part of the state. Many Californians are worried about the effects on their health. The World's Monica Campbell is usually based in San Francisco's Bay Area, but she decided to get out. Monica, thanks for being here. Why did you relocate?
Came down to my son. He's 2 years old. And after more than a week of seeing his congestion, he was coughing a lot, not sleeping. And we had an opportunity, we had an invitation to get out of town up into the mountains. And we took it. Schools are closed. So at this point, we got to think about him.
Monica used to live in Mexico City. How does this compare? Like even Mexico City on a bad day?
Worst days in Mexico City when kids weren't allowed to be outside is nothing compared to this. I've been to Delhi, nothing compared to this. And you get on the Bay Bridge, you can't see, you know, halfway past it. And you just start to feel it closing in and closing in and people wearing masks. It's very surreal. And, you know, driving up last night through Sacramento, you know, that area, and just seeing how much worse it got, you know, the headlights and the particles that you just see, you know, it's crazy. And I just cannot imagine how people up in Paradise in that area, my heart breaks thinking about evacuees in that area struggling through this. And I would just hope nobody can, I don't know how you can stay in that air up there.
The World's Monica Campbell, you take care now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Let's focus in now on those health risks. John Balmes is a pulmonologist at UC Berkeley. So you're in your office there in Berkeley. What are you seeing out your window? How bad is it today?
The air quality is very bad. I can't see more than a block or two, and I'm on a fifth floor. So I usually have a view of the Bay and downtown Oakland, and I can't even see all of downtown Berkeley.
How is the air affecting you and your family there in the Bay Area?
My wife has asthma, so she's been hunkered down for over a week now, staying indoors. Windows closed. We have an old house that's got a heating system that brings in outdoor air, so we've been cold because we've had the heating system turned off. And when she goes outside, she's been wearing her mask, and she no longer has been able to exercise outdoors, so she is feeling cooped up and a bit depressed about that.
So let's get into the health of this. I mean, who else is at risk with the smoke right now?
It's people with pre-existing heart and lung disease, especially folks that are older with pre-existing disease. Most healthy folks, young and old, will only have irritative symptoms where, you know, their eyes may tear, there's a scratchy throat, and maybe occasional cough. But it's people with, like my wife with asthma, or those with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is usually caused by smoking, but will be exacerbated by this kind of air pollution. And then people with heart disease also have increased risk of acute events.
We keep seeing comparisons about breathing the air in parts of Northern California is like smoking X number of cigarettes a day. What damage can this smoke do?
Well, I really dislike that comparison because, in fact, with every puff of a cigarette, you get about 800 micrograms per meter cubed of fine particulate. And our air today is somewhere around 160, 170. You know, people will say, well, when you smoke cigarettes, you're not out for 24 hours. Well, we're recommending people stay indoors so they're not exposed for a long time at this level. Now, that said, the smoke is similar in terms of content, except for there's no nicotine in this wildfire smoke. So if you are out for a long time and heavily exercising, or a construction worker or a farm worker where you're, you know, having to breathe in a lot of air over a long period of time, then you can start getting serious exposures. And homeless people, which we have, unfortunately, way too many in the Bay Area, are also out there all the time. So there are vulnerable folks in the population, but most of the public is not going to have any serious health effects.
John Balmes, a pulmonologist at UC Berkeley, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So what can we do to prevent wildfires? President Trump says the rest of the world may have some lessons to teach us on forest management. Here he is on Saturday during a tour of areas hit hard in California.
You look at other countries where they do it differently, and it's a whole different story. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have a much different, we're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem.
So let's check in with Finland. Henrik Lindberg teaches at Hame University of Applied Sciences, where he studies forest fires. Lindberg told us that on average, fires damage only a tiny percentage of Finland's vast forests every year.
It's about 0.005, so wow. It's actually a quite small problem.
So everybody's been talking about Donald Trump's very simplistic approach to preventing wildfires, a tool known as a rake. But how does Finland prevent wildfires?
By several ways. One of the most important thing is that we have extremely dense forest road network.
So there are a lot of people, road network that goes through the millions of acres of forest.
Yes. Them. Yes, exactly. And this means that if you detect a fire, you can access it quite quickly before it escalates into a greater fire.
So the high penetration of that road network into the forest in Finland, does that also serve as a fire break? Does that help at all?
Yes, definitely. That's one of the main advantages. Then another thing is that there is an aerial patrolling system which is done in the voluntary basis. So they are local aviation clubs that take care of it. That mostly they are flying these certain routes, and if they detect a fire, they immediately inform the nearest rescue service, which then starts the actions to extinguish the fire. And then third thing that I think is important is that in Finland there is the rescue service is partly based on semi-voluntary or voluntary fire brigades. And especially in the countryside or in the rural areas where you have a lot of small villages, and every village has a small own fire brigade. So they are the local guys who know their forest, and they can quite quickly access to these places.
What lessons can we here in the U.S. and in California find in Finland to help us out with our wildfires?
I would be very cautious to start to advise California, because the conditions and circumstances in all levels, the climate, the vegetation, the fuels that are flammable, the social structure, the population density, they all differ so much that it's very hard to give. I would be very cautious to give any advice.
Henrik Lindberg researches forest fires at the Hame University of Applied Sciences in Finland. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead, we get on board an Arctic icebreaker and meet the captain.
How are you feeling when you're out there breaking up some ice?
Well, like they say in Titanic, that I'm the king of the world.
But it's a whole new Arctic, thanks to climate change. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's face it, the ice in the Arctic region is melting fast. We've been focusing on that every Monday for the past few weeks in our collaboration with the Threshold podcast. Most of the story we've been tracking about warming the Arctic is sobering. We've heard about how it's changing life in the region's native communities and the ways the big melt is bad news for the rest of the planet. But there's another side to the story, and that's what we're going to explore this week. As the ice melts in the Arctic, it's also creating new economic opportunities in the region. Here's Threshold's Amy Martin.
Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're ragged out like the old stuff. Funny, but we'll travel along, singing a song. Ethel Merman was my idol. Side by side.
I'm in Nome, Alaska, with Richard Benville.
B-E-N-E-V, like Victor, I-L-L-E. First name Richard, and I'm mayor of Nome. And that's a kick in the ass.
Nome is a town of about 3,800 people sitting on the southern side of the Seward Peninsula, the knob of land that sticks out into the Bering Sea toward Russia, way out on Alaska's western coast. Richard is giving producer Nick Mott and me a tour in his van.
My ambition all my life, been the theater. I'm a song and dance man. Give me a microphone, a top hat, and a pair of tap shoes. I started tap dancing when I was 6. Hello, Central!
That's his catchphrase. Nome was a gold rush town, and it still feels kind of wild westy, with lots of bars and streets that quickly turned into gravel roads. Richard grew up far away from here. He says he was an up-and-comer in the New York theater scene in his youth, but he had a drinking problem, so his family intervened and sent him to live with his brother in Alaska. That was 36 years ago, and he never left. He founded a tourism company, led after-school programs for the kids of Nome for decades, and he was elected mayor in 2015.
This is a cool town. This is a really cool town. And it's a cool time to be mayor because so many exciting things are happening.
Like
and we'll
what?
Talk about the opening of the Arctic. Then we could start there.
When you say the opening of the Arctic, what do you mean?
You ask what's happening. What's happening is the decreased accessibility of going through the Bering Straits for a longer period of time each year because of climate change. And the opening up of what is referred to by many as a new ocean. And that would be the Arctic.
More ships are now coming to the Arctic, including more and bigger cruise ships. Tourism is booming in many Arctic communities, and cruise companies are offering trips to watch polar bears, go dog sledding, and even view receding glaciers before they disappear.
If people can get there, they'll go. Tourism, according to Dickie.
Some Arctic communities aren't very excited about the increasing cruise traffic. Many towns up here are tiny, so it doesn't take many visitors to overwhelm the locals. Ships full of tourists can also bring pollution and disrupt wildlife, but they bring a lot of money, too. And Richard welcomes them to Nome.
It's an opportunity for us to shine not just Nome, but the region.
In 2016, a ship called the Crystal Serenity became the first large cruise ship to navigate the Northwest Passage, the fabled route over Alaska and through the high Arctic Canadian archipelago. It took 32 days, and Nome was one of its first stops.
Now we have a cruise that begins in Seward, Alaska, comes up, spends, as I say, 800 people come to tea, and then goes on across Northwest Passage, Greenland, and down the eastern coast, Nova Scotia, all of that, and then ends in New York City. Well, now that really is an interesting thing.
Richard wants to deepen Nome's port so even more big ships can dock there, and he's hopeful those ships will bring more than tourists. He sees a future with Nome as a major way station, with ship traffic driving growth in population, jobs, and prosperity. He's not blind to the downsides of climate change up here, but as mayor, his job is helping his community. And if he can harness the forces of climate change to do that, he will. It's a confusing mixture of threat and opportunity here in Nome, and it's part of a story that's unfolding all around the Arctic.
Where do you stand when you are out, like, when you're doing this? I want to stand next to you. We'll pretend we're on the ice.
Okay.
I'm halfway around the world now with Captain Pasi Järvelin on the bridge of an icebreaker named the Polaris in Helsinki, Finland. Icebreakers are like the offensive line of the ship world. They power through the ice, cutting pathways for research boats, oil tankers, military ships. Basically, any craft hoping to travel through polar oceans may need help from an icebreaker. We're up on the bridge at the top of the ship. It's so tall, we actually took an elevator to get here.
So you can go and sit there.
That's your seat?
Yep.
The bridge of the Polaris is sleek and modern, with huge tinted windows and dozens of screens all around. I'm sitting in the captain's seat, trying to take it all in, when suddenly the chair starts to move.
It's, whoa!
Pasi had pushed a button that made the seat roll forward and lock into place, apparently so the captain can stay right where he or she needs to be, even when the seas get rough.
Like, if we were going through ice right now, what does it look like from up here? Like, what would you be seeing? I mean, is the ice piling up on either side of you? Like, what is it?
Well, it's a quite masculine job, yes, I would say.
You feel like a badass.
Yes, like a badass, yes. It's very exciting, and I like icebreaking a lot, yes.
A lot of people in Finland like icebreaking.
There is approximately 130 icebreakers in the whole world, and around two-thirds of those have been designed and built in Finland. So we dare to say that we are the world champion in icebreaking.
This is Tero Vauraste, the CEO of Arctia, a state-owned icebreaker company that owns and operates the Polaris. And believe it or not, Tero says icebreakers are a growth business these days.
So I'm often asked that, well, the ice is melting, who needs icebreakers? But it's actually vice versa. Yeah, there is less ice, but it doesn't mean that the conditions get easier. They actually are more variable.
And as those conditions change, icebreakers are leading the way through, breaking open new trade routes at the top of the world. If you're looking to cross the Arctic by ship, you basically have three options. One of them is the Northwest Passage that cuts through the vast Canadian archipelago. That's the one Richard Benville was describing. On the other side of the globe, there's the Northern Sea Route along the Arctic coast of Russia and Scandinavia. Russia is actively developing this route as a way of connecting Europe to Asia and making money from the ships that pass by. But if sea ice continues its precipitous decline, ships might someday be able to avoid both of these routes and use a third one, the Transpolar Sea Route, more or less straight across the top of the world.
So it means that there will be increase in the transit traffic, increase in tourism, and of course the great investment potential, which is worth $1 trillion, is spread around the Arctic.
All that potential cash isn't just about traveling through the Arctic. A 2008 report from the U.S. Geological Survey said the Arctic is the biggest area of unexplored petroleum deposits left on the planet, with huge potential reserves both onshore and under the sea. Countries and companies around the world are eyeing those deposits, trying to figure out if or when or how they might go after them. Canada currently bans offshore oil and gas development in its part of the Arctic. The U.S. had a similar ban put in place by President Obama, but it was overturned by President Trump. In fact, in late October, the U.S. gave provisional approval for a project off the North Slope of Alaska that could produce the first oil to be extracted from U.S. Arctic federal waters.
But the biggest investment potential is in the Russian areas. About 20% of the Russian GDP is coming from the Arctic areas.
Taro says Russia is already extracting huge amounts of natural gas in northern Siberia, then liquefying it, putting it into tankers, and shipping it to Europe and Asia along the Northern Sea Route. And fossil fuels aren't the only resources in the Arctic. There are also valuable minerals and metals.
Do you feel like there's a danger of profiting off of this kind of global disaster?
That's what everybody tries to put me to. But I'm not going there. Because I'm saying that the Arctic is not a park to be preserved, nor it's a dirty area where big and nasty companies conduct their dirty business. But it's an area where you need to have a holistic approach on whatever you do.
Taro says holistic means thinking about environmental impacts and the people who live in the Arctic, not just profit. But is there a holistic, environmentally sound way to extract oil and gas? There are certainly ways to drill that are more or less damaging, but even if we don't spill a drop in the process, we'll still burn it, and that just speeds up the warming of the Arctic, a process that's already moving fast.
The ice that is receding and melting in the Arctic Ocean, it will probably be gone in 20 or 30 years for summertime.
Renee Setterman heads up Arctic policy initiatives for Finland's Foreign Service. He also serves on the Arctic Council, a forum for the 8 Arctic countries and 6 indigenous organizations. And he says interest in the region is growing quickly.
So you just have to look at the globe and see who might have interests to deal with when that happens. Not only the US and Russia. China recently published its Arctic strategy.
But Renee says it would be wrong to characterize all of this activity as simply a mad dash to cash in on the Arctic as climate change makes it more accessible. He says there's also a lot of cooperation and negotiation. Arctic Council members have agreed to help each other out on search and rescue missions and potential oil spills. They also collaborate on all kinds of scientific projects.
So from this point of view, you could maybe say that the Arctic Council is a confidence-building measure.
That will be important because if or when the Arctic becomes fully navigable in the summer, it could bring waves of change. And not just in the way goods are shipped around the world. Observers say it could rearrange alliances between nations and shift the basic geopolitical order of the whole planet. And there are big concerns about pollution. Any oil spilled from drilling or from ships would be extremely hard to remove from frigid Arctic waters.
What is concerning is that when ice recedes from the Arctic Ocean, there will probably be more traffic on the sea routes, and that will increase the risk of environmental accidents with ships.
There's a whole new world opening up here as the Arctic warms and the ice recedes. There are dangers, there are opportunities, and for many people, like Polaris Captain Pasi Järvelin, there's the thrill of blazing trails through a new frontier.
How are you feeling when you're out there breaking up some ice?
Well, like they say in Titanic, that I'm the king of the world.
You know your captain is confident when he has no qualms about referencing the Titanic while standing on his ship. But the greatest challenge here in the changing Arctic may not come from the ice, but the lack of it. The planet needs polar ice to help keep it cool. But as the Arctic warms and the ice melts, it triggers lots of feedback loops, processes in which warming creates new conditions that just contribute to more warming. And this is another one. The warming Arctic is giving us access to more of the very fossil fuels that are causing the warming. In the long run, climate change will almost certainly be humankind's most expensive folly ever. But, as economist John Maynard Keynes famously said, in the long run, we're all dead. And in the meantime, there's money to be made in a changing Arctic. For The World, Amy Martin, Helsinki, Finland.
Amy's reporting on climate change in the Arctic comes to us through our partnership with the Threshold podcast and radio program with funding support from the Pulitzer Center. You can check out all of Amy's stories at theworld.org/thebigmelt. And if you want the whole season of the Threshold podcast, it's at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Salif Keita, the legendary vocalist from Mali in West Africa, is an albino, maybe one of the best-known albinos in the world. This past weekend, he played a tribute concert in the Malian town of Fana. The location was intentional. Fana is where a 5-year-old albino girl named Ramata Jara died back in May in a ritual killing. After that, Salif Keita vowed to raise awareness of the plight of albinos across Africa. People who have the condition have no pigment in their skin, eyes, and hair. They are often discriminated against. As the story of Fana shows, albinos have even been killed. Superstition and ritual value their body parts. The Salif Keita concert in Fana drew albinos from all over Africa. One of the most prominent, Isaac Mwaura, a senator from Kenya. He told the BBC that despite violence against albinos, there's hope for Africans with albinism.
When I was growing up, I was telling my family that I would be a member of parliament. And they would say, no, you cannot be a member of parliament. Today I am. We are increasingly seeing more and more persons with albinism in places of authority and respect. Last year in Kenya, the best primary school candidate in the whole country was a little girl with albinism because of the many, many campaigns and positive role modeling that we are doing.
Music from the talented Malian singer Salif Keita, a man and a voice that gives strength to albinos across Africa. You're listening to The World. Brazil's incoming president says the Amazon rainforest should be open for more development. Jair Bolsonaro won't take office until January, but deforestation in Brazil is already surging. Data show that it has jumped almost 50% since it became clear that Bolsonaro would become president. That's bad news for the forest and the global climate, because the Amazon sucks up a huge amount of the CO2 pollution that's heating up the planet. Carlos Nobre is a climatologist at the University of Sao Paulo. I asked him if he's concerned about the new government's approach.
It's very unclear whether this new government will get back to Brazil's commitment to reduce deforestation significantly, almost to zero by 2030, or it will continue the trend of the last 4 years and deforestation would increase.
Well, big agriculture, I know, is the main pressure point on the Amazon right now. What is Jair Bolsonaro's relationship with big agriculture?
I mean, everybody expects that he will follow through with conservative policies in terms of defending expansion of the agribusiness. However, this is not widespread view even among his followers. A recent poll, they show that Brazilians fully supported getting rid of deforestation in the Amazon. These figures are 90 to 95% of Brazilians, including, of course, most of the people who voted for him. So I think, you know, now we have a big question whether he will pay attention to what historically for 20, 25 years Brazilians want, which is to stop Amazon deforestation.
I know you've proposed an approach to conservation of the Amazon that would rely more on an active harvest of resources that could come from a standing forest. Would that approach appeal to someone like Bolsonaro, who is a big free marketeer and a backer of economic development?
I hope it will appeal to his government. He appointed as president of the big development bank in Brazil, Joaquim Levy. Joaquim Levy was the president of Federal Reserve during Dilma Rousseff's years.
And the former president of Brazil.
The former president of Brazil, yes. He is really a very good, gifted, talent economist. Dr. Levy is also very concerned about sustainable pathways for development, about environment, about the Amazon. So we hope that Mr. Bolsonaro's government will also have some people like Dr. Levy, which will really steer government in the direction of sustainability. This is very possible because, you know, my proposal and of a few colleagues, it's a proposal really to bring innovations to add value to the value of the forest, to the value of biodiversity. And we are able to demonstrate that an economy, a bioeconomy based on standing forest, on tapping into the biological assets of the Amazon, can be much, much more valuable, productive, and socially inclusive than the current economy.
Carlos Nobre at the Institute for Advanced Studies at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Marco.
We've got more from Carlos Nobre and a deep dive into troubles in the Amazon over at theworld.org/Amazon. And finally today.
Hi, Marco. It's Mark Ritchie from the Yukon in Northern Canada. I'd like to tell you about my grandfather, C.F. Ritchie, in World War I.
Mark listens to us at night on the CBC up in the Yukon in Haines Junction. He came to us with a mood music request. We've been asking you to tell us about your mood in a song or give us a song that you found has adjusted your current mood. Mark Ritchie says he's been pensive lately. The recent 100th anniversary of the end of World War I has been on his mind. So was his grandfather, a Canadian in the 24th Infantry Battalion. He was unbelievably fortunate in a war that left so many dead. Mark's grandfather spent the whole war in Europe. He was one of a handful who made it back to Canada alive. Here's Mark again.
Over the past 4.5 years, I've been reading the official history of his battalion, Victoria Rifles from Montreal. My grandfather was one of the 30 officers that was in the first voyage of the battalion from Montreal. The book talks about every march, every training exercise, every battle that took place. It took me over 4 years to read the book because I read each entry 100 years to the day that each event occurred. The book even included some of the actual orders my grandfather wrote out before some battles, such as how many messenger pigeons would be used for urgent messages in case the telephone lines or the signal flags weren't working. One thing the book didn't include was that each time my grandfather went on leave back to England, he got my grandmother pregnant. I'm currently reading the entries from mid-November 1918, where they're transitioning from the armistice to demobilization.
When Mark first wrote me with his mood music request, he mentioned how the human cost of the war has been clouding his thoughts. I've read that up to 19 million military and civilians died as a result of the war, Mark said in his email.
Now, I never really appreciated how many people died in the war, so I did some math.
And this is what he came up with. From August 3, 1914, when Germany invaded Belgium and declared war on France, until 11 a.m. on November 11, 1918, the war lasted 1,561 days, or about 134,870,400 seconds.
That's someone died about every 7 seconds, day in, day out, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And they did it all over again 20 years later. So when the battalion finally shipped home in 1919, of the original 30 officers that initially sailed over to Europe, Only three came back, and my grandfather was one of them.
Oh, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside?
So in memory of my grandfather and his brother Hubert, who died in the war, my suggestion for this week is The Green Fields of France by Boston's own The Dropkick Murphys.
And I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick and I hope you died clean. Oh, Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene today?
The Green Fields of France, a ballad written many years after World War I, better known as No Man's Land or Willie McBride, requested on this Mood Music Monday by Mark Ritchie, who listens to us up in Yukon Territory of Canada. Thank you so much, Mark, and tell us what your mood is and the song that goes with it. On Twitter, I'm at Marco Werman, and we are at PRI The World. The request feed is open. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you tomorrow.
And did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some loyal heart is your memory enshrined. And though you died back in 1916, to that loyal heart you're forever 19. Or are you stranger?
PRI, Public Radio International.